Can you increase your intelligence? Absolutely. Most people are surprised to learn that intelligent quotient scores can, in fact, be raised. The accumulated evidence has simply become too strong. The theories and experiences that you will be taught in this program are among some of the most powerful advances that have been made and heavily contributed to this evidence. Because of Dr. Win Wenger and Richard Poe and their breakthrough program, the Einstein Factor, everyone now knows that human intelligence can be increased. The challenge is to enhance it more intensely and for longer periods of time. The techniques in the Einstein Factor will help you to do just that. While experiments have shown that the Einstein Factor will indeed raise your IQ, more importantly, they will contribute toward greater goals, elevating your overall brain power, enhancing memory and creativity, reading speed, specific talents, general brain health, and maybe most important, increasing your understanding of the world around you. In this program, you will find the most cutting-edge, most effective, and up-to-date methods available for releasing your Einstein Factor, that secret trigger for ingenious thought that lies within all of us. You will learn about the theories behind many elements of the Einstein Factor, and will be given a multitude of practical exercises that will enhance your intelligence in those areas. Some of the powerful elements from Win Wenger and Richard Poe that Win will cover in this program are image streaming, an exercise to help you explore the vast intelligence that lies within you and an experience you can revisit anytime you want to, your portable memory bank, an ingenious idea that will help you remember all your great ideas and possibly even invent something that will affect mankind. You will be introduced to the borrowed genius exercise, where you literally can become anyone in history that you admire or wish to learn from. You'll also learn exercises to build your power of understanding and how to easily overcome creative blocks. And these are just the proverbial tip of the iceberg. There's much, much more. You'll not only find these exercises interesting, you'll find them fun. Most importantly, we'll prove to you that you are in fact a genius, and how simple it is to tap into your own higher intelligence. With this program, you've been given a guidebook that will help you record your insights from the experiences Win will guide you through. There is also additional information in this guidebook that will help you develop even further your Einstein Factor. You've also been given a portable memory bank that Win will tell you more about in Session 6 that will become your constant ally in developing your genius. The Einstein Factor is the culmination of over 25 years of exhaustive research in accelerated learning and brain function. Through their seminars, tapes, and books, Dr. Win Wenger and Richard Poe have already helped thousands of people find their genius. It is their hope that within this program, you too will find a pathway to insight and achievement that you never dreamed possible. Become part of the brain-mind revolution and those who are seeking a different path to higher intelligence. And now, to get you started on this amazing journey, Nightingale Conant is pleased to bring you The Einstein Factor by Dr. Win Wenger and Richard Poe, presented by Dr. Win Wenger.
Hi, this is Win Wenger, and it's good to be with you. Welcome to Exploration of Your Einstein Factor. The good news is that the Einstein Factor is within you and in nearly every one of us. The truly great news is that your Einstein Factor is so readily accessed and brought to good use to enrich your life. Together, then, let's explore and enjoy your Einstein Factor. Here, you will find some of the most effective and up-to-date methods available for releasing your Einstein Factor, that secret trigger for ingenious thought that lies within all of us. Some of the highlights included in this program are innovations such as image streaming, photo reading, free noting, and borrowed genius. IQ is only one partial measure of intelligence. While experiments have shown that some of these techniques will indeed raise your IQ, as a whole, these processes will contribute much more towards a more important goal, elevating your overall brain power and enhancing memory, creativity, reading speed, specific talents, and general brain health. The Einstein Factor is the culmination of 30 years of research in accelerative learning. Thousands have already been helped by these techniques. We hope that in this program you, too, will find a pathway to insight and achievement that you never dreamed possible. And now let's begin. What I call the Einstein Factor is the genius that each of us has within us. We all have it. The good news, of course, is that we do have this tremendous resource within all of us. And the great news is that it's so easy to tap and put to good use. And we know now from a couple of centuries of psychology and behavioral science, one of the most fundamental laws of behavior is the law of effect, that you get more of what you reinforce. And every time you examine your own awarenesses and try to respond from those awarenesses, you're reinforcing not only that particular awareness, but you're reinforcing the behavior, the trait of being more aware. You get what you reinforce. There are several main reasons why we ended up calling this program the Einstein Factor. And it's not just because Einstein is a genius that everybody recognizes was a genius and therefore it's an easy reference point. Much more important was the fact that Einstein was using processes that any of us can use, which built his intelligence to where it was a genius. Einstein started out mentally retarded, at least mildly so. But the processes, especially the imagery and the things he was doing with that imagery, were a large part of building the intelligence that eventually made him be a household word for genius. The other major reason is that a large part of this program revolves around extensions of his technique. He is famous for because he's the first major scientist to have acknowledged that in public, and in fact as a very part of the process by which he was advancing his theories, that his work was based on vision, on visual thinking. And visual thinking is so profoundly useful that it's a large part of the program that we offer here. Perhaps the most famous of Einstein's deep thought experiments in which he used vision, he would let his imagery run freely in his mind and observe it as closely as he could and see what he could learn from his imagery. The most famous examples of that had to do with relativity. He was asking himself questions like, if I'm going at the speed of light on a train, let's say, and I'm looking in a mirror, will I see my face? And much to his surprise in his imagery, he couldn't see his face in the mirror, but he was noticing all sorts of other and strange effects in his imagery as he played this little mind game, you might say, of imagining being on a train that's going at or near the speed of light. And this developed his theory of relativity. Fifty years ago, most of the same universities which today dismiss the very idea that human intelligence can be improved were then spitting on the very idea that creativity could be trained, built, learned, or improved. The worldwide creativity movement has blossomed for the past 50 years. Some of the techniques for training or building creativity are in widespread use. Some of the very same universities which spat on the very idea that creativity can be improved now sport their own academic departments of creative studies. A funny thing happened to intelligence on the way to scientific validity. We have no trouble accepting that intelligence can be lowered by damaging injury to the brain, by drugs and disease, by long-term sensory deprivation. Yet the other side of that same coin, that intelligence can be improved by improving the health and physical condition of the brain, or by appropriate stimulation instead of deprivation, this simple consideration seems to have eluded some of my esteemed colleagues, along with the evidence from many different directions, demonstrating intelligence being improved, sometimes drastically improved, as in the gains in intelligence made by some physics students at a state university in Minnesota using one of our techniques called image streaming, which you will learn in this course. Their IQs, one partial measure of intelligence, shot upward at a rate of 20 points permanent gain for only 25 hours easy, entertaining practice of image dreaming. One of the most important experiences and processes that we can do and we'll cover in this program is one we call image dreaming. Actually, yes. During my 30 years in the field of accelerative learning, I have seen the human mind perform many wonders. One such marvel made a deep impression on me. In 1981, during a seminar I was conducting in Ravenna, Ohio, one participant, whom I will call Bob, had a remarkable, perhaps life-saving, encounter with his subconscious mind. We were practicing a technique called image streaming. In this case, I had instructed the group to pair up and take turns describing aloud to their partners, with eyes closed, whatever mental images popped into their heads. During an image streaming session, it is vital to report every image that you see, no matter how vague, trivial, or puzzling it might be. But Bob had trouble following the instructions. When he closed his eyes, he immediately got a perfectly clear image of an old automobile tire. But instead of reporting it to his partner per the instructions, Bob tried to block the tire out of his mind. He refused to believe that this is what he was supposed to be seeing. "I kept telling my partner I didn't see anything yet," Bob wrote later, "and kept on trying for something else. But my partner kept after me to describe anything, blobs, lines, or whatever. So I finally started yattering about this old tire that kept coming up." As Bob described the tire to his partner, a realization crept over him. He had seen this tire before. Indeed, it was the right rear tire of his fiancée's car. But why was it appearing to him now so vividly and persistently? "I had the impression there was something wrong with it," Bob recalls. "I excused myself from the exercise, dashed out and phoned my fiancée. I got her father, and he was the one who went out to check that tire. He found the side of that tire was bruised and cut almost through. Had the weakened tire blown out on the freeway at 65 miles per hour, it could easily have killed everyone in the car." This message from Bob's unconscious may well have saved his fiancée from deadly peril. This incident involving Bob stands out not because it was unusual, but because it is typical. Our subconscious minds, your subconscious mind, spew forth streams of images, hunches and subtle perceptions almost 24 hours a day, many of them charged with insight and premonition every bit as vital as Bob's. Like Bob, most of us fail to heed these messages. Confronted with an urgent, life-saving warning, Bob's first impulse was to squelch it. So it is with most of us. We all have this squelcher running in us. Day after day, year after year, the vast majority of people squelch their most profound insights, mostly without even knowing it. More than any other factor, this defensive reflex, which I call the squelcher, blocks us from achieving our own full mental capacity. We have with the squelcher a bottleneck in our attention. Like most people, Bob had been probably trained from infancy to ignore the stream of perceptions that welled up ceaselessly from his unconscious mind. "Stop daydreaming," his teachers probably chided him in school. "Sit up and pay attention." Unfortunately, paying attention is a skill with limited usefulness. Scientists calculate that the human brain can pay attention to only about 126 bits of information per second. Simply listening to another person talk occupies about 40 of those 126 bits. That leaves only 86 bits of attention with which to watch the person's facial expression and to think about what you're going to say next. Yet our minds are flooded each second by perceptions involving hundreds of times more than those 126 bits. Experiments have shown that the human retina can detect a single photon at a time, that the nose reacts to as little as one molecule of scent. These and many other minute perceptions flow constantly into our brains, but these perceptions are squelched before they ever reach consciousness. That explains why, in certain rare cases, brain injuries will trigger extraordinary leaps in sensory ability. What happens to subtle perceptions when they are squelched? Contrary to common opinion, they're neither lost nor destroyed. In fact, the latest evidence suggests that human memory approaches 100% retention. We remember potentially everything. Yet most of these memories lie so deep in the unconscious that, until quite recently, psychologists had no means of retrieving them other than inducing a profound hypnotic trance. If you play tennis, your coach has probably told you 100 times to keep your eye on the ball. Most of us assume that this means we should pay attention to the ball, but that is actually physically impossible. A tennis ball in flight will always outrun the speed of your conscious thought by about a half second, because it takes a tenth of a second just for the image from your eye to reach your brain, and another 400 milliseconds for you to form a conscious perception of the ball. If tennis players relied on paying attention, every ball would just smack into the fence before they could move their rackets. Striking a tennis ball is only one of the simpler tasks that your unconscious mind can perform. Its capabilities are stupendous. Bob's unconscious took note of a tiny mark on an automobile tire, probably out of the corner of his eye, while Bob was focused on something else. From that wisp of information, it diagnosed a dangerous flaw in the rubber and purposefully strove to bring that problem to Bob's conscious attention. A set of actions that required not only intelligence, but a keen sense of responsibility as well. We might almost imagine Bob's unconscious as a separate person with superior perceptions, constantly looking after Bob from within. An impression strongly reminiscent of the ancient belief in guardian spirits. It is to such ingenious spirits that the ancients attributed all wisdom, insight, and artistic inspiration. And yet this ancient view is not all that far from the truth. Each of us does indeed possess a thinking machine vastly superior to our feeble consciousness. The mathematician John von Neumann once calculated that the human brain can store up to 280 quintillion, that's 280 followed by 18 zeros, 280 quintillion bits of memory. Many call that a conservative figure. Estimates of the brain's speed of operation have ranged from 100 to 100,000 teraflops. A teraflop is a trillion flops, the standard measure of computing speed. Despite all this awesome computing power in our heads, most of us are hard put to multiply two-digit figures without resorting to a calculator, while even fewer can manage the New York Times crossword puzzle or remember what they had for dinner last Wednesday. Only the Mozarts, the Einsteins, and the Da Vincis, an infinitesimal sliver of humanity, seem to use their brain power efficiently, and the evidence shows that even they employ but a fraction of their intellect. So stupendous do their talents seem to the rest of us that we look upon such geniuses much as the ancients did, as divinely gifted beings endowed with what appear to be supernatural powers. But are geniuses really so different from the rest of us? Now let's look at the notion of this elusive genius. Are geniuses really so different from the rest of us? You would hardly think it by looking at their school records or job histories. Seldom do bona fide geniuses distinguish themselves early in life. Many are labeled difficult, or slow, or even stupid. The renowned mathematician Henri Poincaré did so poorly on the Binet IQ test that he was judged an imbecile. Thomas Edison, whose record 1,093 patents outstripped every inventor in history and transformed human life, was notoriously slow in school. My father thought I was stupid, Edison later recalled, and I almost decided I must be a dunce. As a child, Albert Einstein, too, appeared deficient to his elders, partly due to his dyslexia, which caused him great difficulty in speech and reading. Normal childhood development proceeded slowly, recalled his sister, Maya Windler Einstein, and he had such difficulty with language that those around him feared he would never learn to speak. Every sentence he uttered, no matter how routine, he ended up repeating to himself softly, moving his lips. This habit persisted into its 7th year. Young Einstein's poor language skills provoked his Greek teacher to tell him, "You'll never amount to anything." Einstein was later expelled from high school and flunked his college entrance exam. After finally completing his bachelor's degree, he failed utterly to attain either an academic appointment or any recommendation from his professors. Forced to accept a lowly job in the Swiss Patent Office, Einstein in his mid-20s seemed destined for a life of mediocrity. But in his 26th year, Einstein did the unexpected. He published his special theory of relativity, which contained his famous formula, E equals MC squared, in the summer of 1905. 16 years later, he had won a Nobel Prize and become an international celebrity. Even today, 40 years after his death, Einstein's numinous eyes, bushy mustache, and shock of silver hair remain the quintessential image of genius for us, his name a synonym for supernormal intelligence. But what did Einstein have that we don't? That's what Dr. Thomas Harvey wanted to know. He was the pathologist on duty at Princeton Hospital when Einstein did die in 1955. By sheer chance, fate had fingered Harvey to perform Einstein's autopsy. Without permission from the family, Harvey took it upon himself to remove and keep Einstein's brain. For the next 40 years, Harvey stored the brain in jars of formaldehyde, studying it slice by slice under the microscope and dispensing small chunks to other researchers upon request. His goal? To uncover the secret of Einstein's genius. Nobody had ever found the difference that earmarked a brain as that of a genius, Harvey later told a reporter. So it was mainly an idea of seeing what we could find. Harvey himself never found anything, but one of his colleagues did. After examining sections of Einstein's brain in the early 1980s, Marion Diamond, a neuroanatomist at the University of California at Berkeley, announced an amazing discovery, one that may revolutionize ideas about learning and genius. Most people assume that geniuses are born, not made. But Diamond has devoted her career to creating genius in the laboratory. In one famous experiment, Diamond placed rats in a super-stimulating environment, complete with swings, ladders, treadmills, and toys of all kinds. Other rats were confined to bare cages. Those rats who lived in the high-stimulus environment not only lived to the surprising age of 3, the rat equivalent of 90 in a human, but their brains increased in size, sprouting forests of new connections between nerve cells in the form of dendrites and axons, spindly branch-like structures that transmit electrical signals from one nerve cell or neuron to another. The rats who lived in bare cages stagnated and died younger. Their brains had fewer cellular connections. Not only that, but when Marion Diamond raised some of the rats in those stimulating environments but not able to take part in the stimuli directly, they had to, in effect, look over the shoulders of the other rats that were playing with the toys, those rats' brains turned out to be as totally deprived and shrunken as were the rats that were raised in isolated environments. It was the rats who got to play directly with the toys and got the feedback from their own play action that got the benefit of the stimulus. As long ago as 1911, Santiago Ramón y Cajal, the father of neuroanatomy, had found that the number of interconnections between neurons, called synapses, was a real measure of genius. Diamond's experiments showed that, at least in rats, the physical mechanism of genius could be created through mental exercise. Did this principle apply to people? Diamond wanted to find out. She obtained sections of Einstein's brain and examined them. As she expected, Diamond found an increased number of glial cells in Einstein's left parietal lobe, a kind of a neurological switching station that Diamond described as an association area for other association areas in the brain. Glial cells act as a glue holding the other nerve cells together and also help transfer electrochemical signals between neurons. Diamond expected them because she had also found high concentrations of glial cells in the brains of her enriched rats. Their presence in Einstein's brain suggested that a similar enrichment process had been at work. Unlike neurons, which usually do not reproduce after birth, glial cells, axons, and dendrites can increase in number throughout life, depending on how you use your brain. Diamond's work suggested that the more we learn, the more such connections are formed. Likewise, when we cease learning and our minds stagnate, these connections shrivel and dwindle away. The implications for educators is clear. If Einstein's brain worked anything like the brains of Diamond's rats, it may be possible to create new Einsteins by providing sufficiently stimulating mental health. Let's look at Einstein's own theory of genius. What sort of mental exercise would correspond in the human to the swings, ladders, treadmills, and toys of Diamond's super rats? Einstein himself had some ideas on this subject. He believed that you could stimulate ingenious thought by allowing your imagination to float freely, unrestrained by conventional inhibitions. For example, Einstein attributed his discovery of the theory of relativity not to any special gift, but rather to what he called his retarded development. A normal adult never stops to think about problems of space and time, Einstein mused. These are things which he had thought of maybe as a child, but my intellectual development was retarded, as a result of which I began to wonder about space and time only when I had already grown up. And in his last autobiographical note, Einstein recalled the first crucial insight that led to his special theory of relativity. It came to him unexpectedly while he was daydreaming like this. At the age of 16, what would it be like, Einstein wondered, to run beside a light beam at the speed of light? Normal adults, according to Einstein, would squelch such a question before it was ever formed in their minds, or having formed it, would quickly forget it. How many times have you had an oddball thought like that and left it behind somewhere, never responding to it? Perhaps this is what Winston Churchill meant when he said that most men stumble over great discoveries, but most then pick themselves up and walk away. Einstein was different. With no clear idea of where it would take him, Einstein played with this question for a full 10 years. The more he pondered it, the more questions arose. And with each new question, he came closer to the truth. Suppose, Einstein asked himself some years after posing his original question, that you were riding on the end of a light beam and you held a mirror before your face. Would you see your reflection in the mirror or not? According to classical physics, the answer was obvious. You would not see yourself in the mirror because the light leaving your face would have to travel faster than light in order to reach the mirror. But Einstein could not accept this answer. It fit all the known facts, but for reasons he could not put into words, it didn't feel right to Einstein. It seemed to him ludicrous that a person would look into a mirror and see nothing there. Trusting his intuition more than he trusted the known and accepted laws of physics, Einstein boldly envisioned a universe that would allow you to see your reflection in a mirror even while riding a light beam. Only years later did he follow up his vision by proving his theory mathematically. It was gut feeling, far more than mathematical rigor, that led Einstein to the answer. Invention is not the product of logical thought, Einstein concluded, even though the final product is tied to a logical structure. Let's get a little closer to Einsteinian method as such. With few exceptions, the great discoveries in science have been made through just such intuitive thought experiments as this. Einstein did not invent this technique, but because he was his most famous and active partisan, I have called it Einsteinian discovery technique. Another source of Einsteinian discovery procedures is Sidney J. Parnes's book, Visionizing, State-of-the-Art Processes for Encouraging Innovative Excellence. This book comes from the Creative Education Foundation. It's wall-to-wall with a brilliant array of Einsteinian discovery-type experiences and procedures. Psychologist Robert B. Diltz recently studied every surviving scrap of information about Einstein's scientific thought process, drawing upon Einstein's correspondence with Sigmund Freud, as well as upon detailed interviews that Einstein granted to Max Wertheimer, the psychologist and founder of Gestalt Therapy. Diltz's biographical study yielded some remarkable insights. Instead of words or mathematical formulas, Dilts concluded in his 3-volume Strategies of Genius book, Einstein claimed to think primarily in terms of visual images and feelings. Verbal and mathematical representation of his thoughts came only after the important creative thinking was done. In fact, Einstein attributed his scientific prowess to what he called a vague play with signs, images, and other elements, both visual and muscular, what we today would call kinesthetic. This combinatory play, Einstein wrote, seems to be the essential feature in productive thought. Regarding his theory of relativity, Einstein told Max Wertheimer, "These thoughts did not come in any verbal formulation. I very rarely think in words at all." In Einstein's vague play with images and feelings, I see a mechanism at work similar to that which helped Bob save his fiancée's life. Remember that automobile tire. Einstein and Bob both lacked the capacity to solve their respective problems through conscious thought. Bob achieved his insight through the technique of image streaming. Einstein used a private method of his own, but both drew upon subtle insights from outside. Let's look at the knack of being a genius. Over the years, my studies have led me consistently to the conclusion that geniuses are little more than ordinary people who have stumbled upon some knack or technique for widening their channel of attention, thus making conscious their subtle, unconscious perceptions. They usually develop this knack so early in life that they completely forget the secret by the time they grow up. Most geniuses are later, therefore, every bit as mystified as the rest of us as to how they managed to achieve such extraordinary results. Here's an example from baseball. Some years ago, I visited a friend in Chicago. My friend's son was trying out for the high school baseball team, but feared he wouldn't make the cut because of his poor batting average. I worked with the boy for about an hour, employing many of the techniques that you will learn to use later in this course. In the course of our session together, the boy discovered that he had the greatest success when he imagined a tiny fly speck on the baseball and aimed his bat at that fly speck rather than at the ball itself. This fly speck, then, gave him just the extra focus he needed to connect with the ball. This may seem a trivial insight, but its effect on the boy's game was astonishing. In baseball, a 250 to 300 batting average is considered quite good. But during his first 10 games of the season, this boy batted 800. He not only made the team, but went on to be named most valuable player for both the team and the league for that year. In one single one-hour session, we had succeeded in identifying a technique that made this boy a baseball genius. But the most surprising discovery for me was yet to come. I did not see this boy again until several years later. He was still playing baseball, and he clearly remembered our one-hour session as having marked the turning point in his athletic career. But the boy had entirely forgotten the details of what he had learned during our session. He remembered nothing about the fly speck, and no longer consciously envisioned it when striking the ball. Indeed, he was as mystified as his teammates as to just how he had become such a great batter so quickly. This raises question about talent, doesn't it? It's easy to argue that this boy must have had a talent for baseball all along. I'm sure he did, but when I met him, there was no talent in evidence. By every objective standard, he was doomed to fail. Only when he discovered the trick of the fly speck were his latent talents catalyzed. In fact, all of us do possess hidden talents, often in the very areas where we think ourselves least capable. Study, practice, and hard work can bring around incremental improvement. But if we wish to unleash the full power of our genius, we must find that crucial catalyst, that simple trick or knack that will bring our bodies, senses, and minds into critical focus. I call that catalyst the Einstein factor. Or indeed, you and it's you I'm talking to, you are brighter than you think. Conventional education and job training are notoriously effective at crushing our confidence, squelching our most brilliant thoughts. Most of us learn early to suppress our natural genius. Like young Thomas Edison, we allow others to beat us down until we see only a dunce when we look in the mirror. In reality, you are far brighter than you think. The techniques we will share together in this experience will help you reverse years of conditioning. They will help you find the fly speck that will work for you. No two people access the Einstein factor in exactly the same way. I can't predict what form your fly speck will take, but your unconscious mind can. Your unconscious mind can emerge as a powerful and ever-present ally if you only allow it.